clap for me, so that's pretty good. Oh, we're good? Hello, how's it going? My name's Finn. As Sean alluded to, I am wearing multiple hats. I've also got this in my pocket, which I've just realized, but I think I'm just going to commit to it. So, you know, go full on that. I think I have to lock it in there, otherwise it's weird. So I, for a few years, was on staff at Pathway, but now I'm a pastor, and some of you instantly go, oh, crikey, another one, out at Sumner Anglican. So, and then you might hear Anglican, some people in the room go, oh, jeepers creepers. But let me say some positive things about myself to endear myself to you after you find that out. I have two children, they're very cute. I have a third one coming in October. Not nearly full Catholic, they're very close together, but not quite. What else can I say? That's about it. I also just sent Jane and Rory. That's very fun. Hey, guys. As of 2025, there are over 10,000 people in prisons here in New Zealand. Within about 2 years, 60% of people who leave prison are back inside. This phenomenon is called recidivism. Many recidivists appear almost endlessly to cycle through a sequence of offending, conviction, imprisonment, release, and rapid return to further offending. This obviously has a substantial impact on our community, and most tragically for the children of recidivists. They are far more likely to get caught in that same cycle. In many ways, they are set up to fail. The question for the church in some way must be, is there anything we can actually do to help? Does the hope of Jesus only apply to middle-class white people, or can it break through even into the darkest places? I was pretty much with that one. Pathway is something that is trying to answer that question. Is how can we, if Jesus says, hey, go hang out with the poor and the prisoner, what can you practically do in the 21st century that actually is helpful and meaningful? And so initially, Pathway, it's a bit confusing the start. Depending on who you talk to, you get different stories. And I'm aware Jane and Rory here, and they probably know more than I do. But it comes out of Brickin Community Church, and it was basically three blokes. And I don't know if anyone remembers. I certainly don't because I was five. But in the 2000s, early 2000s, there was a lot of homeless in the square. So heaps of churches were doing like barbecue ministries, like some Friday night soups and whatever, all that good stuff. There were three guys there from Brickin Community Church who were going, and they were rocking up and doing the barbecue, and they were kind of like, okay, this is cool, but this isn't actually breaking the cycle. This is good relief. This is important work, but it's not transformative and kind of game-changing. So one of the things I found was that most of the guys who were homeless were unable to get work because they'd come out of prison, or they were jumping in and out of prison, you know, kind of that classic cycle. So they said, oh, gosh, there must be something we can do about this. So initially they had a great idea, which in hindsight, atrocious idea, but at the time, good idea, of, hey, let's start a cheer company and we'll hire these guys to do the cheer building. And then everyone's like, yeah, well, hey. So they start running it. Basically, classic kind of early church ministry in the 2000s gets bankrolled by the church like crazy. Rickon Community in particular sinks hundreds, like a lot of money into it. It didn't work because, with all due respect, chair making, like industrial chair making, is a skilled job, and these guys were not skilled workers. So they lost money dramatically. So they ended up going, okay, what if we offsource the chair making people who know how to make chairs, and then we use the money to fund a reintegration and social service program? So that was the idea, was let's run a really well-run business and then use the profit to bankroll a charity so that we don't have to be dependent on government funding or anything like that. Because anybody who's worked in charities will know, I think you're at Stepping Stones for a while, eh? So anyone who's worked in charity will know that if you're dependent on government funding, you're always kind of just going, jeepers, when are we going to make it to the next paycheck? You might have to change programs rapidly out of nowhere, even if your program is working. The whole model behind this was like, let's not have to rely on that funding. Let's be able to fund ourselves so we can do the work in season and out of season so it works well. So fast forward 20 years to where we are now. Very short summary. We run a thing in the prison, Christchurch Men's Prison, called the NI. It's called the Navigate Initiative. It is a unit of about 20, we call them to order, which means to stand in wellness, 20 prisoners who are coming towards the end of their sentence. And it is Basically, we're trying to set them up so that when they leave, they don't go back. Or if they go back, it's for something really small. So the next time they come out, they don't go back in. Is that the kind of idea? You're trying to break that cycle. So it's about 20 beds. It's kind of an awesome, it's a pretty cool place. It's like the best place in the prison. It's brilliant. You've got underfloor heating. You've got electric guitars. You've got piano. Speaking of piano, I'm getting distracted. Where's the piano player? He was very good. Jeepers. It was tasty. Before I became a Christian, I was kicked out of jazz school. It's a whole thing. But anyway, we've got 20 beds. It's and we've got this great common hall, and we have volunteers like Jane who go in and they do different things. I'm sure you're loving the public attention. Volunteers who go in and they run things like writers groups or faith support groups or different things like that, and trying to wrap the community around these guys so that when they get out, we provide the same support when they get out. They have an inside and outside the wire support and a network around them, which means that if they feel like they're going to fall or fail or do something really silly, they have someone they can call. So we have do that. We do that with volunteers like Jane. We do that with staff like Machu, who've kind of walked the walk, talk the talk, know what they're doing, so that we are able to provide different things. And I'll get more into this later on, but I'm just going to tell you a quick story before I go any further, because I think you might be like, what the heck is going on here? But this is actually really helpful. We have a volunteer. I can't tell you his name because of privacy reasons, but that's a whole thing. He would love to have everybody know his name, but I can't tell you. He's got a really crazy story with gangs and the whole different thing. But he now goes into the prison and they run a faith support group. The basic idea is that Jesus actually seems to be quite good at giving people hope. Who would have thought? So in the darkest places, let's send some hope in, right? And that goes alongside all the other work we do. He's been going in pretty much consistently, even before our unit existed, for about 20 years into the prison. Every Monday night, wonderful bloke. He was driving down the driveway to the prison. If you've ever been to the prison, it's like super ominous. It's a proper drive. Like you go out, then you turn left, and it's just this really long kind of, oh, heck yeah. All right, then you go over a bump, and then there's this big gatehouse that comes towards you. And he's driving along there, and he's like Captain Zeal and Passion, right? So he's frothing all the time. But this time, he feels something different. He feels dread, and he feels exhaustion, and he feels weariness. And he said to himself, he told me this, he said, I don't think I can do this anymore. He had run himself into the ground after years of faithfulness to these guys. I can't, for different reasons, I can't actually tell you the amount of stuff he's done, but take my word for it, there are dozens, if not hundreds of guys who are outside in the community whose lives have been genuinely transformed forever, and they're not in prison because of this man. And he just had this feeling of like, I can't do it anymore. I'm done. But no one else had turned up, so he goes in anyway, and he's like, all right, then whatever, I'll have to turn up. And he said it to me like this. I went like a robot through the gatehouse and security. I got my radio and slowly walked to TP, which is a unit. He was leading a group in TP. We do, quick caveat, we have our unit and there's other units. Some of our guys are allowed to go into other units and do stuff too. He went into TP and he had no idea what he was going to talk about. And to be honest, I didn't even care. He walks in and sits down and about 15 to 20 guys come in and they sit down to hear about Jesus. And then he sits down and he goes, I don't know what I'm going to talk about. And in the back of his head, he hears this, like, and then just kind of ASMR time, Luke 15. And he's like, eh? And then the same thing again, Luke 15. And he's like, maybe not that creepy, but the general idea. And he opens it up to Luke 15, and it's the story of the prodigal son. Do we have that slide? Oh, we do! It's magic. I'm going to read that out. I'm just going to turn around slightly awkwardly. This is the parable of the lost son. If you've been in church for any period of time, can you, what? Oh, whoa! Man, my church needs one of these. Oh, that's awesome. That's spectacular. I look way less goofy now. If you've been around church for any period of time, this is like the one that Christians weaponize all the time in the most wonderful way. It's a good story. This is the words of Jesus. Jesus continued, there was a man who had two sons. The younger one said to his father, Father, give me my share of the estate. So he divided his property between them. Not long after that, the younger son got together all he had, set off for a distant country, and there squandered his wealth in wild living. After he had spent everything, there was a severe famine in that whole country, and he began to be in need. So he went and hired himself out to a citizen of that country, who sent him to his fields to feed pigs. He longed to fill his stomach with the pods that the pigs were eating, but no one gave him anything. When he had come to his senses, he said, "How many of my father's hired servants have food to spare, and here I am starving to death? I will set out and go back to my father and say to him, 'Father, I have sinned against heaven and you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me like one of your hired servants.'" So he got up and went to his father. But while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and was filled with compassion for him. He ran to his son, threw his arms around him, and kissed him. The son said to him, "Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son." But the father said to his servants, "Quick, bring the best robe and put it on him. Put a ring on his finger and sandals on his feet. Bring the fattened calf and kill it. Let's have a feast and celebrate, for this son of mine was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found." So they began to celebrate. He read that out, right? Oh, we don't need that next bit. I don't know why that keeps in there on the slide. Sorry, that's me. He read that out, and he's just like reading it out like a robot, you know, classic Bible study stuff. And he just looks up. Everyone's crying. The whole room, like 15, 20 hardened criminals who've probably done some very, very raucous things, are all weeping. And here's why. For most of the people in that prison, as I've already alluded to, they either don't know their fathers or their fathers were horrifically abusive. So the idea that there is a God who doesn't just kind of sit aloof or wants to abuse them, but actually runs to them and aims to redeem them and restore them is utterly earth-shattering. And it's not like an ambiguous hope that's just kind of like, oh, we hope because we get to hope. It's actually grounded in the reality of Jesus of Nazareth, right? Because Jesus of Nazareth is this person who entered history and is God in flesh, we are able to have a legitimate hope. And that's what matters to guys in prison. They don't want just another person rocking up and being like, oh, you can have hope because Freud said you could. Pish posh. It doesn't work. But Jesus can offer something different. So Steve, you know, I've just told you his name. His name's Steve. He leaves that session and he goes to the next unit. 16 men enter, and he's still feeling that same exhaustion and dread. The same thing happens. Luke 15, back of his head. Once again, less creepy voice than mine. So he does the same thing, and once again, these hardened criminals, he doesn't expose it, he doesn't give it like a talk about the loving nature of the Father. He just reads it, and they all start weeping. And at the end, one of them who's never come before says, "I have a message for you, Steve." And Steve is like, oh, crap. You know, like, what gang have I annoyed? Like, realistically, that's probably more likely what's going to happen. And then it's this kid who's never been before, and I wish I could tell you his name because it's so on-the-nose Christian, it's not funny, but I definitely can't tell you that guy's name. I won't do it. Jane's like, "You're the one who talked about privacy all the time, right?" I'm like, "Yes, I was, Jane. I'm aware. Thank you." He says, "Okay, what's the message?" And this kid goes, "Steve, you are not meant to stop coming in here and talking about Jesus. You have a gift from God. He has called you to this, so don't stop coming in." Bear in mind, Stephen has told nobody about this. He's felt this, like, I'm never coming back thing as he's walking in. He's not going to say to the prisoners, "Hey, I'm going to give up on you guys. I'm never coming back." So nobody knows. But this person has rocked up for the first time and felt compelled to come in and tell him, You can't stop. And then Steve freaks out, tells them what he'd been experiencing. And here's why I share this whole story and why you're probably wondering what I'm doing. They've been talking about the prodigal son, right? About a God who welcomes home and searches out the lost. And then God chooses to deliver to Steve, through this young prisoner who's never met, a message that hits right at his heart. Why this is important is because God could have totally chosen 45 people from his church to do the same thing. He could have waited to Sunday and someone could have rocked up and said, "You know what, I just feel like you want to give up on church, on the prisoner, Steve." But he didn't. He used and he saw this random kid who had never met Steve before, who felt compelled. Can you imagine how important that would have been for that kid. In Genesis, we meet this character called Hagar. I mean, where Hagar brings up a lot of different feelings with different people, but just let's ignore all of that and get to what I'm trying to say and not bring up the problems. Hagar captures the energy of a person who has been utterly rejected by everyone around her, particularly those who have power over her. Yes, she doesn't make wise choices herself, and that's a whole other part of the story, and she's not excused from that, but ultimately she was never set up to succeed. There are plenty of people in prison who have felt unseen their whole lives, and this lack of seenness contributes to the decisions that land them in prison. Hagar says of Yahweh, which is the name of God, "You are the God who sees me." And in that moment, zooming back to the prison in 2024 or whatever it was, God proved that he saw those prisoners and that he wasn't done with them. This young man was used by God. The Spirit could have chosen plenty of other people, but he chose him instead. We serve a God who welcomes anyone home and who sees those whom no one else sees. And such a vital part of Pathway is what we do, is trying to create space. Has anyone heard the word of shalom? Shalom is like this. It's a biblical word, means wholeness or as it should be-ness, right? So think of a circle. If I'm drawing a circle, it's all really, really fun. Oh, look at this great circle. Oh, I haven't completed the circle. This is not shalom, because this is not what a circle is. It's not as it should be. But if I complete the circle is now shalom. So what you're trying to achieve, and little micro parts in what people do in works of justice through the church, is achieving little moments of shalom. And that's what we're trying to achieve with Pathways, these little moments where families are reunited, people are transformed, people are not who they once were, and someone completely, is that Holly? No, it's not. It looks exactly, is that Holly? What are you doing here? Hi, Holly. Hey, buddy, how's it going? That sounds really creepy with no context. And it sounds really creepy when I'm about to say, oh, I was on holiday with Holly last week. But anyway, got distracted. I just got so thrown off by, what are you doing here? Where are your parents? Anyway, we want to create places at Pathway where that shalom enters in little beautiful moments. We have a couple of phrases that we use at Pathway to sum this up. We create possibilities, not promises, and sometimes miracles happen. And we are flying kites and we're praying for wind. So I think we've got a Pathway wheel. Do we have the wheel on the next slide? Oh man, sorry. All right, this is the wheel. The wheel is magical, magical little wheel by a really good marketing team. So let me really quickly show you. So big point, no government funding. This is all no government funding. As I kind of alluded to, trying to achieve some form of shalom and wholeness and restoration means there's more than just like you send some social workers in. You have other problems you need to address. So this is kind of what we're doing. So up the top, Allofold. Allofold is a monster commercial seating business now. So they just did the stadium. So that was them. If you don't like the chairs, you can blame us. But like I said, all of the profits and everything like that is coming from Allofold. That's how we can run a massive unit like what we've got and not have to take government funding and not have to take prison money from corrections, is because we partly run through that, and then we are also funded by churches and individual donors, because even Allofold, with all of its profits, can't cover everything we actually need to do. Then we have, it's called Oak Tree, which is the thing on the left. Oak Tree is a way of going, okay, maybe they can't make chairs, but we can give them some work, some skill, so that when they can kind of re-enter the world, they can re-enter the workforce in some way. Oak Tree is a container unloading business, and it has turned, once again, into a bit of a monster. It's massive. It's kind of turned into a social service in itself, because we employ people who come out of prison, but we also employ people who are, say, 19 and don't have anything on their CV. So they need just something. They're like, oh my gosh, I just need something on my CV. Oak Tree will hire you. And it's contract, it's all on the, basically all on your phone. So you just get like a notification saying, are you going to take the job? And then you go unload some containers and you get paid. It actually has turned out to be a really good and simple way of people who just need something to have something and to kind of have a feeling of meaningful physical work. So that's Oak Tree. Oak Tree is in Christchurch. We've got one in Auckland. We've just started Brisbane. Is that right? Brisbane, yes. We're in Brisbane now. And then on the right, we have social enterprises. So we kind of help train up future social enterprises. We have affordable housing. So we have a whole affordable housing wing that's really kicking off in the past couple of years. But once again, the idea is they need to be able to have somewhere to live. So we own reintegration flats. So if someone moves out of the prison, doesn't have anywhere to live, we can house them, but it's not a long-term solution. So we have as well affordable housing, so social housing registry, and we can kind of sneak people a little bit up the list. You know, we can do some things that people who we know, who are our clients, we can probably get them into a house. We're not massive scale at all, but the dream is one day to be doing really good high turnover. And I think that is one of the calls of the church in the future, is to be working really big on housing. We own land out in Mochikarara, so we used to run a retreat out there that is now being run by Odyssey, I'm going to say. Is it Odyssey? Has it changed? Let's go Odyssey. Let's go Odyssey. But that's kind of, once again, a drug and alcohol retreat thing. It's all very, very cool. Reintegration, so that's macho and stuff like that. Inside and outside the wire, volunteers. You're trying to have this whole comprehensive picture of, you need the community to come in. You need the community ready to receive them. And if you come in, people are leaving the prison, there's this element of affirmation of like, hey, yeah, you've done some real silly things, but we want to give you the best shot at welcoming you back for the sake of you, but also for the sake of the community and for your children. So that's kind of what the reintegration thing is doing. And then support and employment, we have different ways. If someone has left with skills that they might have gained in the prison or had before the prison, how can we help them get back into some kind of meaningful work whilst also acknowledging it's kind of hard, sometimes for good reason, once you've left the prison, to get work. So that's kind of this weird tension we live in. There are amazing organizations who do work with young people, rangatahi, and do a spectacular job. We're at the other end trying to crack the cycle before those young people get hurt. So it's actually very, very difficult and challenging work. But it's so worth it, and it's spectacular. And to kind of talk about that transformation, this is where the charisma comes up. I'm going to invite Manchu up, and then I'll get up and do a sell at the end. Come on, buddy.
Kia ora, tēnā rā koutou katoa. Mihi aroha ki a koutou. E mihi ana, e mihi aroha nui ki a koroa. Ki te matua, ki te whaia, Sean and Jill. Thank you for everything you've done in my life. I love you both. So, yeah. So, Finn, you know, one thing I do want to say is I get to heaven and Jesus actually sounds like this. Matthew. Like he said, Steve, he said, welcome. I'm going to be, Lord, can we change, please? Because I don't know if I could do eternity of, so, well done, good and faithful servant. So, that's just a side note. Anyway. So I guess, you know, our beautiful brother has done the you know, the how. And I want to talk about the why. The why should we work with men in prison? Men who have done terrible, terrible things. And they have. Why should we? And I guess in order to tell you why, I'd like to tell you my story. Because I am one of those men. And so what Pathway does is what was done for me. So just who I am as a person, I wouldn't work for a place that didn't put their money where their mouth is and their heart and their feet and what they say. And so on paper, I shouldn't be here. If you looked at my history, my crimes, the drugs I did, the violence I did, there is no way that I should be here. There is no way there should be a little girl in the back that says, that's a very safe man, because I was far from. But in order to tell you that, I need to tell you about my childhood, and I need to tell you about my parents. And so I'll start with my father. His name is Tamati Wedamu Gray. He was a very handsome man, as you can tell. And he was born around Mangamanu, Kaikoura. And he grew up in a time where the reo was removed, so his father and mother were not allowed to speak te reo. They weren't allowed. So they grew up. He grew up not knowing any of his whakapapa. He also grew up in a time when this thing called alcohol had infiltrated the Māori community. So my nana and his mum, my nana, and his father, my koro, they loved to drink. in order to be able to drink, they thought it'd be a great idea to tie him to a clothesline while they went out and got drunk. My nana thought it'd be a great idea to beat him when she came home drunk. And so what happens to a boy when the reflection of wahine and the reflection of womanhood is violent towards him is that inside of him, he grows up with a disdain towards this essence called female. He might have not known it at the time when he was a child, but as he grew older, there was an internal rage towards wahine that my father carried. And obviously, he grows up to become a man. Now, way down in Waimate is this other human being that's born called my mum. And she grew up with incredible abuse from the male figure. And what happens inside of a wahine sometimes when she's growing up with abuse from men is that she grows this disdain for the tāne, for the male aspect of this thing called the human race. And she grew up. And what they both wanted to do is get the hell out of town where they were from and go out into the world. And so they did. My father became a hustler. I was told he could sell ice to an Eskimo, that he had the gift of the gab, and some might say I've inherited that. Some may say that I've inherited that. My mum, she went all around the world, and she became an exotic dancer, which is a very flash word for stripper. And anyway, one day, he walked into a pub, and she walked into a pub, and they went, wow. The trauma in him looked at the trauma in her, and they went, shall we play our trauma out? And they went, yes, let's play our trauma out. So as it is, it starts off beautiful and amazing until a few years later when he's beating her up every night. And she's drinking, and there's violence. And somehow in that mix, there was a child born. So July 23rd, 1975, which means, yes, I just turned 51. That's a miracle. I was born. And I was born in that environment. Now, my dad, he was great at many things. He was great at making lots of money illegally. He was great at making a lot of babies. He was not so good at staying around to bring them up. And so he did what he did best. I turned about one and he went, whoa. Yeah, and I didn't really see him until I was 13, and then I didn't really see him again until I was 40. But I was in this house with this wahine who was very angry, and she did not like males. And unfortunately, I was one. And so all her rage and all her violence and all her hurt that she hadn't resolved, got poured into me. And what did I say happens to a boy who gets abused from the wahine model? He grows up with rage and anger towards women. And I did not know that at the time, but I grew up. I also grew up around this little unknown gang called the Mongrel Mob. And they were pretty cool to me. Yeah. My brother, my father's son, not my mum, he was the sergeant at arms for the mob, so he'd turn up. And he'd turn up with all the mob. And my cousins were all in the mob. And I'd be like, "Fah, these fellas are cool, man." Because I had no male role model. So these guys were kind of the male role models. And I absolutely mean this when I say I also grew up at a time when this new genre of music called gangster rap was coming out. And it was men talking about women, drugs, being hard, making lots of money, and being a gangster. No male role model. I wanted to be a gangster. That's what I knew. I wanted to be a gangster. And so I proceeded to leave home at a very early age. I was probably my first time on the streets, I was 13, 12 or 13, and that's where I like to live. I like to live on the streets because home's not too good. I like to drink, I like to sniff glue, and I like to hang out with gang members. And then when I got a little bit older, I was introduced to this drug called heroin. And the first day I had that drug, I remember all that pain and all that grief and all that fear and all that insecurity went, pshhh. Yeah. And I was like, I found the thing. I found the thing. Yep. And then I got into a relationship. And it went wonderful. And I remember the first time she said, blah, expletive, 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 you, expletive, expletive. And I went, I'll never do that again. I continued to do that many, 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 many times in a row. And then, of course, in order to get heroin, you've got to do crime. And, of course, when you do crime, eventually the police catch you. So then I've got to go to jail. And being the wonderful, embracing, redemptive place jail was, where they just embraced me and helped me grow, I never went back again. Or what happened was I learned how to hustle better. I learned how to fight for my life. I went and did weights. I got on boxing bags. I had to fight other people. And I got really good at the craft of being a bad mother brother. I got really good at my craft. But this other thing happened in jail. People would turn up and tell me about that dude called Jesus and that there was hope. I thought they were a little bit weird. They were a little bit weird. What was their angle? Yeah. But they turned up anyway. And I could go on and tell you about my life from that point on, but it was drugs, alcohol, violence. Except I kept having these breaks in the chain where people in the community would get around me. I remember one time I was walking down the street, I had no hope, I was lost. And I went, you real mate, because I'm a bit screwed. I didn't use the word screwed. I went, can you just show me your real? Can you give me something? And I remember, I just finished praying it, and a little old lady tapped me on the shoulder. Excuse me, young man. Do you want to come to church? I was like, whoa. Oh, freaky. Yeah, and little things like that would happen. I remember I stumbled into a church, and I found these two beautiful people called Sean and Jill, and they wrapped around me for a while and loved me. And over again, the face of Jesus turned up. And in the disguise of different human beings, some opened me up to the idea that perhaps there was a hurt little boy inside of me, and the violence that I was expressing was rage and hurt from my childhood. And that maybe I needed to, through a scary word for hard men like me, cry. Yeah. And I remember there was this guy, his name's Lawrence, ex-Mongrel Mob member that had changed his life around. And he said to me, I love you, Machu. And I went, and he goes to me, I love that hurt little boy inside of you. And the stuff started to leak out of my eyes. And it didn't stop leaking for 10 years as I went on this healing journey. And time again, it was people in the community that got around me and helped me discover how to heal, how to find myself, and how to think different. And as a result, my life changed. I turned 14 years clean this year. Awesome, May. But it's not just because of me. It's because of person after person after person who got around me. And what they gave me is generational. That little girl over there has no idea about trauma, fear, rejection, violence. She knows safety. She knows love. She knows the masculine is safe. So if she knows the masculine is safe, she's not going to repeat that cycle that my mama had. So it's intergenerational, this thing called change. And so I'm just one story, but the reason I work for this place called Pathway is because that's what they do. They believe. And I'm going to finish on, I love going into the unit. And there was this man in there, eh? And I'd go in there and I'd go, kia ora matua, old fella, built like this big, love you. And you'd go, And about a month later, I go, after telling him every time I see him, love you, he goes, that means love you too, and too scared to say it. Yeah. Yeah. And then about 4 months in, I go, love you, and he'll go, love you. Fast forward a year, when I walk in the unit, hey, love you. Love got in. And time again, I have watched love get in. And all I have done is replicate what was given me. And I will do that for the rest of my life to honour you too. Yeah. That's all I've done. And that's all Pathway does. So if you want to jump on board and help in any way, please. Lives change. And when lives change, children's lives change. And it makes a difference for the next generation. Nō reira, tēnā koutou, tēnā koutou, tēnā reira tātou kātou kātou. Kia ora, thank you.
Oh no, he's back, jeepers. It's always hard following Macho up because he's just like, it's Macho, isn't it? It's kind of not fair. I've just got a couple of things I just want to end with, and then we'll see you free to do whatever Baptists do after church. I think we've got a how you can help us thing. Yeah, so if you're a roaring Pentecostal, which I haven't met one here yet, but if there is someone here, please pray for us. That's dope. We think that's really important, genuinely really important and foundational. Bike project. These are the things that when I last talked to John, things we needed a bit of help with. We run a bike project in the youth unit. So it's under us. It's a whole separate thing. It's we go in and teach a few little kids how to fix bikes, spectacular, and then they get some skills, and then we flip the bikes just for free to whoever needs them. So it's just a little side hustle that we've got. But we always need people who have some skills in that area to kind of get involved because it's a specific volunteering need. So if you are interested in that, feel free. I think we have some reports. We've got some contact info and stuff somewhere. Over there, spectacular. Wow. Over by the food. Yes, if you want to get in touch, just get in touch with John and he will direct you the right way. He's a good man. He's just got to go and be a parent right now, which, you know, come on. But and mentors, probably one of the most transformative things that we do, the volunteers do, is a thing called mentoring. It's not like your classic mentoring of like top down. It's coming alongside one and someone walking alongside as like a friend, kind of a, we call the language like a friend for the journey. So it's someone who's getting ready to come out of prison to be another person that they can kind of go to. And often what we'll find is that the Tawada will end up trusting the mentors and telling them things that actually we don't know ourselves. And that's actually a really special and beautiful thing. So we're always looking for more mentors. So once again, get in touch with John. And financial support, once again, ILM historically has given money, and we are so grateful for that. I want to honour that. There are people in this room who are really generous to us. I want to honour that and say thank you. We couldn't keep doing this without you, genuinely. Like I mentioned the big monster business, that still doesn't make enough to fund a unit in the prison and the staff team we have. And there's always more we can be doing as well. So it's like the classic, you know, like, if you want to contribute to something that we think is genuinely meaningful and transformational, that's another way as well, but I'm not sitting here doing a tithe bucket thing. Well, I might do, I won't. And anyway, so I just want to say thank you for having us. Thank you, Sean. It's been great to see Jill again. I haven't seen her in a hot minute, and she's not listening to me, so that's pretty cool. I could say anything right now. Anyway. But in all that, I want to say, here's the vision, and what Mark just alluded to. The vision is this: transformed lives leading to transformed families, leading to transformed communities, leading to transformed generations. And it's about those small wins or in that kind of language of shalom. It's about those little moments of as it should be-ness, right? So like a man who lives his life away from the mob so that his kids don't get dragged into it, because he knows if he goes back to where he's from, the mob will kind of surround his family. That's a massive sacrifice for him, but he does it for the sake of his kids. It's about the young woman who turns her life around again. I should quickly allude, we do work with women, have done it historically. We don't at the moment just for different reasons, but the plan is to do that once again. As she turns her life around so she can see her kids and she's working again. She got custody from her kids back. We didn't do anything particularly great. We just once again, it was what happened to Machu. Come alongside, be there, pick up the phone when they call. There's a guy who, in the faith support team, he came to faith in the prison through the volunteer team. When he gets out, one of the volunteers hires him on his orchard. He then helps him to establish a business. He then helps him to get a house. Then this guy's partner, the prisoner's partner, separately has her own faith transformation journey. They both reconcile. I will disclaimer that they got into prison. They both got in trouble with the law for encountering each other in different violent ways. It was not good. They reconciled, and then separately, and then they reconciled, and now they see their kids together, and they're back together. It's crazy. And it's once again just because we were able to open the door, let the volunteers in, and say, you go. You do the thing. You do the stuff. The impact that this couple have is genuinely staggering. And the amount of stuff that we just, because we're able to get them in the door, they're able to then do. And when people get out, they're able to then do, is genuinely beautiful. And I wish I could tell you more, but I can't because of so many privacy laws. I get in so much trouble. This work can be painful. People can relapse. They can die. That has happened. They can do things out of our control. It just takes one moment. And whilst we'd like to tell you everything is rosy, it doesn't happen either. But it is worth it for those little moments of glory where a vision of like what God always wants things to be breaks through into now in the simple moments of a restored life or a changed family. So I just want to say thank you for having us. It's a real, real blessing to be here. Great piano playing, Japers, well done. Very nice. And yeah, honestly, we feel honored, and hopefully you feel encouraged about what God's doing in the presence, and there's cool things happening. Bless you all.
Ngā mihi nui, Finn, and also Machu for sharing, you know, not only painting a picture, but sharing pieces of your heart with us around this. I wanted just to create a little opportunity. We won't have time.